The rest of today, I just want to lay out what these anticipated upheavals are, or why we anticipate that there have to be some upheavals in our notions of space-time and perhaps even quantum mechanics. So this lecture in particular, we're going to be flying relatively high, and I'm going to try to give you a very broad brush understanding of both the old synthesis and where things are expected to break down and why. So we're going to cover an insane amount of intellectual ground in the little time available. Starting tomorrow, I'll actually tell you actual things. Okay. So we'll start. I mean, I can't give you an entire course in the right way of thinking about relativity, an entire course in quantum mechanics, an entire course in quantum field theory, but we can do salient bits and pieces that will at least hang some of the crucial physical concepts and ideas to a few of the crucial formal ways of thinking about them. Okay. So, and hopefully it'll minimally inspire you to be motivated to go through some of the, you know, dealing with the traces of gamma matrices when you're learning QED, to remember that it's about these life and death issues ultimately. but also a few, another thing I will try to do is tell you as many slogans for the right ways of thinking about certain kinds of physics as I possibly can. You'll find it's very surprising, but it's incredibly, it's a little surprising, maybe not very surprising, but it's a little surprising that it's possible to summarize a lot of the correct ways of thinking about tricky physics issues by a correct slogan. It's often important to just remember what the right words are, and you'd be surprised how useful it is to know that there is a right way of thinking about things. When you're stuck in the middle of a calculation, because more and more you'll find that when you approach things in the sort of morally, physics-wise, morally correct way, life will be easy. When you do things in a perverted way, life will be hard. And if life is hard, then it's an indication that you're doing something wrong. And if things are going well, it's an indication that you've also set up a problem morally correctly. So I'll try to give you as many good slogans as I possibly can. For example. This is a slogan I learned from Lenny Susskind. Only perverts think in momentum space. Okay, so this will come in handy, as you will see. You will see in your life, you know, when you're stuck in the middle of some confusing calculation in momentum space. Say, wait a minute, let me think about this in position space. Physics is local in position space. You go back, you think in position space, you get the right answer. There's lots of little slogans like that, and so since I can't give you entire courses on everything which is needed, I will at least try to populate the lectures with the right ways of thinking about things so that you have something to hang on to. If some of your wonderful future lecturers, you know, happen to try to corrupt you to do things the wrong way, you can remember. But no one's going to corrupt you to do anything, as far as I know. But in order to set the stage, I want to give a very broad brush view of the universe. Okay, so this characterizes this little picture. Shows the various length scales that people who think about fundamental physics tend to talk about, from the longest to the shortest. So at the very longest distances, we have the size of the observable universe, around 10 to the 28 centimeters, so 10 billion light years. Okay, so the universe is very big. The universe is pretty flat. It isn't all curled up and on ridiculously tiny curvatures. It's pretty big, pretty old, pretty flat. And astonishingly, as we discovered in the late 1990s, it's accelerating. So the universe is expanding. But on top of that, in the last billions of years, the expansion rate, instead of slowing down, has started speeding back up again. Okay, that's an amazing fact. It's amazing what a single piece of experimental input can do to a subject, and is completely turned upside down the way we think about fundamental physics. In fact, the very deepest problems that I will mention at the end of this lecture, the very hardest one, the very deepest one, the one that I actually suspect is too hard and deep to work on right now, and is going to take a little while. Other people disagree with me, but I think it's just too hard a problem to attack right now. And there are problems that are almost as hard, but which are accessible, that I think we should be working on. But the very, very toughest problem, and the one that causes a little bit of questioning, even about whether quantum mechanics is the ultimately correct way of thinking about things, all stems from the fact that the universe is accelerating today. Okay, so that one piece of data has a gigantic influence on how we think about things. Okay, so these are the three scales that we think about all the time, and every single one of them is associated with some crisis. Okay, so I want to tell you what they are. Okay, at the other extreme is a scale that we've encountered already, is this Planck length, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. At the moment, we've encountered this simply as the place where gravity becomes strong. Well, actually, I'll quantify that in a second. That's the length scale associated with gravity. Okay. In the middle is another length scale, which is not as popularly well known, but is another very, very important length scale, which is called the electroweak length scale. And it's at around this distance, in fact, around 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. Energies of order 100 GeV. Okay? So 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, the energy would be around 1,000 GeV. So 10 to the minus 16 centimeters, the energies would be around 100 GeV. It's at around those distances that, for the first time, we see the essential unity between the strong, weak electromagnetic forces. It's at those distances that we first start seeing that they're all described by exactly the same basic kind of mathematical structure. Okay? The sort of mathematical structure, it's a special case of this union of special relativity and quantum mechanics that I told you about. The basic rubric is quantum field theory. But it's a specific kind of quantum field theory that governs particles that have a spin that goes up to spin 1. And it turns out that if you're going to describe particles that have a spin that goes up to spin 1, that includes things like the photon, but also other particles, the W and the Z and the gluons, if you want to describe it in the language of quantum field theory, there's a specific sort of framework that's forced on you, and that we have to describe them in terms of what are called gauge theories. Part of the slogans I'll tell you about in the rest of the course is that if you pick up a standard textbook, you'll find odes to the loveliness of gauge symmetry and how awesome it is, and it's this incredible, beautiful, symmetrical thing, and it's all complete crap. So I'll tell you the correct way of thinking about gauge symmetry is a kind of a dirty, crappy thing, actually, and we'll talk about it more later. Whatever word you want associated with it, it is the unique framework with which we can talk about the kinds of particles that are associated with the weak, strong, and electromagnetic interaction. So there's a gauge theory, and we first start seeing that all of them are described by gauge theories at around that distance, around 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. So if you like, the idea that all the forces might be unified, that there's an underlying framework that's the same for all of them, is actually something that experimentally you first start seeing at around 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. And this length scale around 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, we'll talk about all of this later, is associated with the generation of the mass for most of the elementary particles. Like the mass of the electron, ultimately, even though the electron length scale is like 10 to the minus 11 centimeters, it's really tied to 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. Really, fundamentally, there's one length scale around 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, and everything is a sort of derived consequence from that. So this is an invariant interesting length scale, which people have known about for 70 years. Fermi knew about it, but we just happen to be going there today. Okay, so it's we happen to be going there now at the LHC. The reason why each one of these, as I said, each one of these things is associated with a basic mystery, and I will tell you about them. So I'll first start telling you a little bit about what's special at the Planck length. First, in a relatively superficial way, but which will get us going. So here is a set of arguments that tell you space-time is doomed. Okay. So we'll understand why space-time just cannot be a fundamental notion. And that's one basic problem. The other two problems, the other class of problems, has to do with a very salient feature of this picture, which is there's this gigantic gap, huge scales, ratios of scales, between the size of the universe and the Planck length, and this weak scale length and the Planck length. Okay. We'll see, in many ways, it seems like the Planck length is the fundamental microscopic length scale associated with nature. There's no shorter length scales we can talk about. That's one of the reasons space-time is doomed. But given that there is this fundamental short-distance scale, it's a rather puzzling that there are such incredibly macroscopic, relatively speaking, scales compared to the Planck scale. Okay? So the question is raised, why is there a macroscopic universe? And in fact, you'll see that it's worse than that, because it seems that the putting together of quantum mechanics and relativity, a very basic consequence of putting together quantum mechanics and relativity, the very basic consequence being this idea of vacuum antiparticles, vacuum fluctuations, and things that we'll talk about, but a zeroth order consequence of that seems to want to make this picture impossible. Quantum mechanics and relativity seems to want to make it for all these scales to be squashed right on top of each other. And the fact that they're so disparate is actually shocking. If a theorist was given the laws of nature as we know them now, but wasn't allowed to see what the world looks like, okay, this is a little, it's a slightly illogical setup because a theorist wouldn't exist and so on. But, you know, imagine that the laws of nature is handed to some theorist and they asked to predict what the world would look like. They would never in a million years predict that it looks like this. They would instead do a simple back-of-the-envelope calculation that we will do and conclude that all the scales are smack on top of each other. So it's a big shock that there is a macroscopic universe at all. Okay. So why is there a macro world? As we'll see, why is there a macro world in a world governed by microscopic laws with violent short distance or ultraviolet quantum fluctuations? So that's why we're in such an interesting situation. On the one hand, we have an incredibly powerful theory that does not disagree with one experiment. Okay, so we're in this awesome situation where we know what we're doing is right. It's working. Okay? But on the other hand, that very structure that we have allows us to pose questions which are clearly telling us there's something wrong at the same time. Okay? If you don't have anything that works and you're convinced that things are wrong, that's not very helpful. But we're in a great situation that we have a framework that we believe in deeply that works, but which is itself telling us where we should be questioning it. Okay? So we're not stumbling around in the dark. We're inching away from what we have with one foot on solid ground and hoping to grab something on the other side to come up with an explanation to these problems. Yes?
When you say that space-time is doomed, do you also mean that gravity is not fundamentally, the source of gravity is not the curvature of space?
Well, if space-time is doomed, everything is... Gravity isn't fundamental. I mean, there's nothing more basic to physics than space and time. Forget anything else. Physics is supposed to be about describing how things happen in space and time. We're saying space-time can't be fundamental. This is one of the very big zeroth order things that we have to come to terms with, if it's true. Okay? It's very likely true. Not only is it very likely true, there are examples where we understand it perfectly. There's been a huge amount of theoretical progress in the last 20 years understanding how this might actually happen. So it's not just a bunch of words. But indeed, it's not like no one in this business believes that gravity is a fundamental force. Or that, I mean, that entire language is clearly wrong. Okay? Of course, gravity exists. You know, things fall. Gravity in the approximation where there is a space-time, as we'll discuss, the distance is long compared to the Planck length. There may be other much more subtle criteria that have to be satisfied, which is not simply distance is much longer than the Planck length. But let's just leave it for the moment. If distance is much longer than the Planck length, there's an approximate space-time picture. Gravity is a force. Everything else is a force. Everything is fine. But it has to deeply come from something else. And in the examples where we understand it very well, the more fundamental description of the system doesn't have gravity. It's, in fact, in good old-fashioned particle theory, in good old-fashioned four dimensions. But the way gravity in space emerges in that example is incredibly not non-trivial and amazing, but we understand it. So parts of this have been understood, but there are big parts of it that we still have to come to grips with. But I'm just laying out the sort of two basic classes of problems. One of them has crucially to do with gravity and quantum mechanics. The other one has to do with a very qualitative fact about the world, that there is a macroscopic universe at all. Okay? And so what's wonderful is that the problems that we have today are not some technical problem that in the sixth decimal place of some calculation there's a disagreement between theory and experiment. There are the very zeroth order, very basic questions about the world that we can formulate, and we have some real serious puzzles about. So I want to tell you about them. You had a question.
When it comes to the Planck length, since the length is so small, and
let's just talk about it. Let me just say it. I just want to say some of the words. We'll get through it. If it's not clear after I say it, ask me again. Okay. All right. So before starting, I should have said these last two problems have names. So if you like, the space-time doom has many names. It's the problem of quantum gravity. It's the problem of, but really fundamentally, it's that space-time is doomed. And we've got to figure out what replaces it. These other problems are often called fine-tuning problems or naturalness problems. And the specific names associated with the two that I mentioned, the one with why the universe is so big compared to the Planck length is called the cosmological constant problem. And the one with why this weak length is so big compared to the Planck length is called the hierarchy problem. And so those, I think, are very broadly speaking the three basic issues that we have to deal with. Of the three of them, I think in order of difficulty, the hierarchy problem is easiest. Space-time is doomed is the next easiest. And understanding deeply the cosmological constant is the hardest problem of all. Okay, so let's start off with, again, this is going to be very broad brush. Let's first talk about, before getting to these fancier things, what have to be done to put quantum mechanics and special relativity together. So you'll have an entire course on this, but let's just start talking about why there is an issue. First of all, special relativity and quantum mechanics have a different language. In fact, it's surprising that the world is both relativistic and quantum mechanical. Special relativity tells you there's no preferred time. Okay, you can boost. Different observers will use different time coordinates. There's no preferred time. There's no simultaneity, et cetera, et cetera. Quantum mechanics, on the other hand, quantum mechanics loves time. Right? How do you talk about quantum mechanics? You specify the state of a system at some time, and then you evolve in time. Use a Hamiltonian, you evolve from one time to another time. So time plays a crucial role in quantum mechanics. It plays a much more fluid role in special relativity. Okay? So already right there is a source of tension. Because very naively, you say, look, no quantum mechanical theory will ever be relativistic, because I have to choose a frame of reference to define it. In this frame of reference, I move with this Hamiltonian. Okay? Why will another observer agree on what we see? But as I said, it's an example of how you take everything, all the principles you have, ultra seriously. People much more often make a mistake not taking the principles they have seriously enough than taking them too seriously. Okay. So you take them seriously and you say, no, perhaps what's going on is there's some special class of Hamiltonians I can choose, special kinds of evolution, which have the property that, in fact, the answer that you get is the same for every reference frame. Okay. So you try to build special kinds of Hamiltonians which allow the theory to be Lorentz invariant. And that ends up being possible. It looks ugly. I mean, it looks at zeroth order, you think, gosh, you know, why is it these basic principles are so at odds with each other? But you can do it. If you push through your word problems and just look at the equations, the equations are much, much smarter than we are very often. And it's very useful to take their wisdom into account and not prejudice the answer based on our naive preconceptions. Okay? You find you can do it. You find that it is, in fact, possible. It is, in fact, possible to put them together. I want to roughly describe how this works, but just very roughly describe how it works. But but before doing that, let me just tell you ahead of time what the two major qualitative consequences were. The two major qualitative consequences of putting quantum mechanics and special relativity together were, A, most dramatically, the existence of antiparticles. Okay. Antiparticles are a direct consequence of putting together quantum mechanics and special relativity. It's not something that you expect at all in the non-relativistic theory. It's an incredibly surprising prediction. It's a prediction that was so surprising that the person who should have made it, boldly, Dirac, did not. You know, it was a consequence of his equation. It was sitting there staring at him in his equations, and it took him a number of years before he admitted that it was really predicting the existence of these particles that no one had ever seen. And of course, eventually, it wasn't in fact Dirac himself who pointed out that his theory predicted antiparticles. It was Hermann Weyl, who didn't care one way or another if Dirac's theory failed. So he was very happy to point out that Dirac's theory predicted he clearly pointed out that it predicted antiparticles, and of course, shortly thereafter, they were discovered in cosmic rays. So, as I said, one very, very seldom makes an error not taking one's equation seriously enough. Much more often, you screw up by not taking them, by doing the opposite. Anyway, so one dramatic consequence is the existence of antiparticles, and the other consequence is the connection between spin and statistics. The fact that particles of integer spin are bosons and particles of half-integer spins are fermions is another direct consequence of this marriage of special relativity and quantum mechanics. So two very dramatic things happen from this fusion of these two ideas. at least the qualitative argument for the qualitative argument for why for the existence of antiparticles is something probably many of you have seen. But let me just flash through it quickly. So let's say we're talking about so here's a space-time diagram. So here's P and X. Okay. Now normally we say in relativity that if you send a signal from A to B, B had better be inside the light cone of A. Right. So these dashed lines are the lines. It's just a one-dimensional problem. This is the line X equals T. Okay, so if the particle if you did nothing, it would just move along that way. This is sending a signal from A to B, and B is inside the light cone of A. Now, this is nice because while the actual time at which B receives a signal isn't Lorentz invariant, the fact that B receives a signal after A is a Lorentz invariant statement. Okay? If you do boosts, We'll review, in case it isn't at the tip of your tongue, we'll review the very nice way of thinking about Lorentz transformations and relativity and everything later in the course. But for now, if you just even roughly remember that Lorentz transformations move you along hyperbolas, okay, Lorentz transformations move you along hyperbolas in this picture, then in another frame, B will move somewhere along this hyperbola, but it's always in the future of A. Okay? Now, let's say you could send a signal outside the light cone. So let's say you sent a signal slightly faster than the speed of light. Okay? So let's say it went out here. That's going faster, right? I mean, the most extreme thing they might think is that instantaneously you turn on the signal here and it's received there, at a different x, but for the same t. But let's just draw it like this. It's going slightly faster than the speed of light. Well, because of relativity, there's no such thing as slightly faster. It's like being a little pregnant. So Lorentz transformations can move you along this hyperboloid, okay? And in particular, there's some frame in which it appears that B received the signal before it was sent from A. Okay? So that's the textbook explanation for why signals can't go faster than light. If you have causality, then for causality preserved, the signals have got to stay inside the light cone. How many people have seen this argument? More or less. Okay. Actually, if you haven't really seen it, it's fine because the argument isn't quite right, actually. This alone isn't a deadly problem. What that picture tells you is that in this frame, see, I sent something slightly faster than the speed of light and it got to B. There's some frame where I boost a lot and it seems like B receives the signal before it's sent from A. But what it really means is the time on B's clock, what B receives a signal is earlier than the time on A's clock when B receives a signal is earlier than the time on A's clock when A sent the signal. Is that deadly? It happens every time you send an email to the West Coast. Okay? So that's not deadly. So what's actually the problem? I actually leave it as a little relativity problem for you to think about. But the clue actually is that if you could go slightly faster than light, then you've got to combine two operations, two different reference frames, one moving really fast in one direction, one moving really fast in the other direction, and then you can get a situation where you send a signal from A to B, from B back to A, and then the signal is received by A before it was sent by A. So you get in a situation with a so-called closed time-like curve. Okay? So it isn't just this problem, but it's very closely related to this. If you can do this, then you can further also do something where B sends a signal that's received by A before A receives it. But it isn't simply this picture. Okay, anyway. But let's just leave it as this basic statement. All right. Now, the difficulty is quantum mechanics. Because again, this is a very loose statement, but we'll make it more precise in a moment. That in fact I can't perfectly localize that the source is here. Okay, if I can perfectly localize that it's here, then there's some spread, and it's the usual uncertainty principle. Okay, so I can't perfectly localize where the source is. So that means that even though I thought I was turning on some interaction here, there was some small probability that it was really over here somewhere, and it did manage to get a signal out in what appears to be outside the light cone. Okay? Just because there's some fuzz, inherent fuzz in where that source is turned on to begin with. Okay, so that means that if there's some A and it's sending some, let's say, electric current from A to B, then there is a current passing, there is a net flow of electric charge, let's say negative electric charge, from A to B. But A, B is outside the light cone of A, so if you boost in some other frame, we look like we have the problem that it's going, that the current is going backward in time from A to B. So what has to happen, so again, you would say, this is yet another argument. You might make these moral, qualitative arguments. We can't put special relativity and quantum mechanics together because then we would violate causality. That's what I think the most naive person would say. But there is a way out. And the way out is to interpret what happens here in a different way. This observer would interpret what happens in a different way than this observer does, still preserving causality. This observer would interpret what happens as a flow of positive charge moving forward in time from B to A, rather than a negative charge flowing backward in time from A to B. Okay? But even for this rough kind of argument to make sense, there had better exist some particle out there with exactly the same mass, exactly the same quantum numbers, everything exactly the same except the charge has got to be flipped compared to the electron, let's say. So you see that to even have a prayer of making quantum mechanics and relatively consistent, there has to exist antiparticles because of this basic qualitative argument. Okay. So antiparticles are the first way of understanding that first dramatic consequence of putting together special relativity and quantum mechanics. Now, antiparticles, in turn, completely change our picture of the vacuum. Okay? Why? Well, so let's say, I'm a terrible artist, so I have to apologize. This is a magnifying glass, okay? So let's say we're looking at some region of space with a magnifying glass, okay? So let's say I'm trying to resolve some distances or times of order r. Then by the uncertainty principle, I have to, there's some energy, uncertainty in energy in that, let's call it t, it doesn't matter. But there's some uncertainty in energy, which is of order 1 over t. Let's say that's delta t. Some uncertainty in energy, which is of order 1 over delta t. Okay. And now what happens is if I try to make delta t smaller and smaller, this uncertainty in the energy, I need to put more and more energy in that small region of space. And when that energy becomes larger than the rest mass energy of an electron and a positron, nothing stops me from producing an electron and a positron out of the vacuum. There's no quantum numbers. There's no energy is conserved. Everything is fine. Okay, I can produce out of the vacuum simply by looking at it an electron and a positron pair. That happens when delta E gets larger than around m electron c squared. Well, I'm not putting any m electrons in. Maybe 2 if you want to say there's an electron and a positron. So it corresponds to delta t's, which are of order 1 over m electron. Again, this Compton wavelength of the electron that we talked about. Okay, so these kind of times, these sort of distances, you start seeing that just the act of trying to verify that the vacuum is empty, you're just checking that it's empty. It's not empty. You just the act of checking it produces particles and antiparticles. So that means that that what the vacuum does, what you see, depends on how you're looking. It depends on the distance that you're looking at, the energies you use, and so on. Okay. The vacuum is an exciting place. If you have this boring classical picture of an electron sitting there with its electric field lines going out forever, that classical picture of the world is just wrong. As you get the distances of order this Compton wavelength, so as you get the distance of order 1 over ME, you should think any measurement you do, any question you ask, any magnifying glass you might imagine, would see not just the central electron, but would be producing all over the place around it electrons and positrons. Now, if you go to even shorter distances, you'll see even heavier particles. So there's the muon. The muon weighs 200 times, a lot more than the electron, 100-something times more than the electron does. Okay? So then you'll see that guy. Okay? As you go to shorter distances, any heavier particles, you'll eventually see them too. Okay? So there's a whole roiling mass of so-called virtual particles popping in and out of the vacuum. This is all very qualitative, but if you look at it with a magnifying glass, any experiment you do will eventually probe and see those virtual particles. Okay. Now, often, just to make a comment, often people say that accelerators are like the world's biggest microscopes. Especially if you talk to people who actually use actual microscopes, they'll ask you, what is it looking at? It's not like looking at a piece of hair or something like that, right? What is an accelerator like the LHC looking at? And the answer is that it's looking at the vacuum. You're not putting a piece of hair inside the LHC, but it's actually probing the vacuum. It's taking snapshots of the vacuum. Okay? And of course, you do that by colliding particles with each other at very, very high energies, and then and you excite things out of the vacuum. The world is quantum mechanical, so even if you do exactly the same experiment in exactly the same way over and over again, what comes out isn't the same every time. Okay, so you study what comes out, you learn about the structure of the vacuum. But that's really the sort of big business of fundamental physics, is all about the structure of the vacuum, understanding what the vacuum looks like. Okay. Okay. Let me mention another thing. While we're here. This existence of antiparticles is maybe the most important consequence of the marriage of special relativity and quantum mechanics, most important qualitative consequence. And it also solved a variety of important puzzles that people had before, that classical physicists had. This is a very good example of the philosophy of radical conservatism at work. So I want to, when I can, a few times I will give examples. Okay, let's go back to the year 1900. In the year 1900, people like Lorentz and Abraham and other people, classical physicists, were very bothered by the following simple fact. They were very bothered by the fact that if we go back to this picture of the electron, here are the electric field lines, okay? They're bothered by the fact that there seemed to be an infinite amount of energy stored in the electrostatic field surrounding the electron, okay? So let's remind ourselves what that argument is. The electric field around the electron is E over 4 pi r, okay? Let me not worry about the 4 pi's. Oh, let me worry about the 4 pi's, okay? R squared. Okay? So the energy is the integral d cubed r of E squared, right? So this is the integral d cubed r e squared over 16 pi squared r to the fourth. Okay, well there's some 4 pi in there. So this is the integral dr over r squared times e squared over 4 pi. Okay, so this is our friend alpha. So you see that, let me not call it alpha yet, actually, for once, because these are classical guys. They didn't even know about h-bar yet. Sorry. So I'm not going to put the alphas in for now. But notice that this thing is divergent. This is divergent. As r goes to 0, this is divergent. Okay. So if we put a cutoff, it's linearly divergent. If we put a cutoff and say that I'm only going to integrate down to some r min, let's say I'm going to integrate down to what I'll call some size a, then this is of order e squared over 4 pi times 1 over a. Okay. Now, what did these people say? So this is an example of a puzzle, right? You're taking your theory, you're taking it super seriously, you compute something, and now you run into a paradox. Because if that a gets arbitrarily small, and as far as they knew, it was a point-like electron, nothing else, right? Then there's a problem. Then the energy is infinite. If you imagine that, just slightly abusing history, that energy would be associated with some m via equals mc squared. So the electrons would be incredibly massive. Okay. So what did they do? They did what sensible, radically conservative physicists do, which is they said, Something has got to give. So this picture of a point-like electron cannot be valid down to arbitrarily short distances. This was their argument. Okay? And it has to break down and be replaced by a new picture somewhere. Where should it be replaced by a new picture? It should be replaced by a new picture at distances A such that this guy is comparable to mc squared of the electron. Okay? So let's figure out where that happens. That's called the classical radius of the electron, and it happens when e squared over 4 pi, 1 over a, let's call it 1 over a classical radius of the electron, is comparable to m electron c squared. Okay? So it's when a classical is m electron c squared, 4 pi over e squared. Okay? What am I doing? I can't even divide. A classical is e squared over 4 pi, 1 over m electron c squared. Thank you. Okay? Now, and what did they try to do? Well, again, you do the best you can. So they said perhaps the electron is actually around that big, and it's a little shell of charge. Okay? And they really tried to build theories like this. In fact, you know, Lorentz and his friends were no dummies. Lorentz discovered Lorentz transformations. He understood about Lorentz transformations. That's why his name is attached to them and so on. And they were trying to understand why moving rods contracted. Okay? So they thought that really there's some mechanical property of the electron. It's held together in some way. It has a size. And when it moves, it bends, it shifts. Everything changes. Lengths dynamically change and so on. When Einstein came along and said, no, there's such a thing as a symmetry. There's a new symmetry of nature called Lorentz invariance. These things just happen. There's kinematic consequences. They just happen. It's not like Lorentz was bowled over by the revolutionariness of it all. He's like, no, you're cheating. That's not physics. Physics is explaining why lengths contract. You're not explaining it. You're just legislating it. Okay? But of course, Einstein was correct. You know, that turns out to be the deeper way of a more correct way of thinking about it. But this is why I want to stress: it's not like these old fogies couldn't absorb new ideas. They could. In fact, often the problem is that they set up the rules of the game to not be satisfied with the correct answer. Okay? But anyway. That's a little bit of history. They were very happy to build these mechanical models of the electron. The trouble is that not one of these theories made sense internally. They couldn't actually build a concrete theory that kept the electron together and not have it blow itself apart under the strength of its own interactions. It's not so hard to understand why, because, you know, at this scale, right at this scale, it's very hard to imagine any controllable calculation working. Because you're in a situation where an order one amount of the energy of the electron is contained in its electric field. That whenever you don't have an expansion parameter in physics, whenever there isn't some small parameter that's controlling things, it's very hard to make progress. And anyway, it's not surprising that they failed. Okay? However, the problem that they set up and the nature of the solution that, in other words, they said something new would better happen at least by here, right? It had better not be that the classical picture of the electron makes sense to arbitrarily short distances, much smaller than a classical. Something has got to give earlier. They set up the problem, you know, it said, this problem needs a solution. We're trying to solve it by making the electron have a finite size. That solution isn't going anywhere for now. Well, the ultimately correct solution needed to await relativity and quantum mechanics. And the correct solution of this problem, there is no linear divergence. The correct solution is that this is not the picture of the electron. The picture of the electron is that it's surrounded by this virtual cloud of electrons and positrons. Okay? Yes.
There was another alternative suggestion that Born and Infeld for solving this problem. Why did that not work? Or is there
any maybe I'll defer a discussion of that to a little bit later. That has many other problems. That's thinking of that as a solution to this problem is just in blatant contradiction with experiment. But the basic Born-Infeld idea is an okay one. But as a solution to this problem, it is not. But I want to go through this exercise just to show you that these guys were not fools. Okay. let's see that this solution actually conforms to this basic philosophy. When does this new stuff happen? The light scale associated with this new stuff is this picture is breaking down to the scale which is h bar over m electron c. Right? That's the Compton wavelength. Let's compare h bar over m electron c, which is where this picture starts breaking down, compared to this classical radius. Okay? So we have a actual breakdown. This is where dead happened had to happen by. The actual breakdown is h bar over mc. Okay? So the ratio of these things, a actual to a classical, is h bar over m electron c times 1 over e squared over 4 pi m electron c squared, which is nothing other than 1 over e squared over 4 pi h bar c, which is 1 over alpha. This new quantum picture kicked in 137 times earlier than it had to. Okay? So they were right. They were not wrong. They had a problem. They said something new has got to come in. They didn't know what all the ingredients there were out there. They didn't know the world is quantum, there's virtual particles, there's all that stuff. So the only place they could see to fix things up was the classical radius of the electron. But just because they got the ultimate answer wrong doesn't mean that the philosophy wasn't right. It was exactly correct. This picture of the classical electron changed. It changed not only at the classical radius of the electron, but this weak factor, the small number that we know associated with the electromagnetic interactions played a role. And 137 times bigger distance than the classical radius of the electron, you start seeing that the electron is this big fuzzball with a core electron surrounded by this cloud of stuff. And that cloud of stuff completely screens this linear divergence, by the way, obviously, okay? Because you no longer see, when you get to shorter distances, who is the central electron, okay? You don't see that picture anymore, so the linear divergence gets cut off, okay? Okay. All right, so putting together relativity and quantum mechanics gives us antiparticles. Antiparticles means that the vacuum is exciting. Perhaps in a later lecture, I was thinking of doing it today, but since we're spending most of today talking about relatively qualitative things, I'll defer to a later lecture a more technical explanation for where antiparticles come from. Okay, so that at least I'll give you the logical structure of the explanation for where antiparticles come from. All right, but let's keep going. So that's the basic lesson. We put together relativity and quantum mechanics. There's antiparticles. The vacuum is an interesting place. And then there's a lot of other machinery that goes into describing specific kinds of particles and forces. Let me just say the following, just so you have some of the slogans, that it turns out that the rules of relativity and quantum mechanics are so rigid, the rules of quantum field theory are so rigid, that the only possible way of describing, and something new happens when, backing up for a second, putting together relativity and quantum mechanics forces us to talk about the spin of particles. And something interesting happens with massless particles. Massless particles, you can't boost to any frame where they're at rest. So massless particles have the peculiar property that they only have helicity. They don't have a full spin. Okay? So a spin one particle, a massive spin one particle, you can go to some frame of reference where it's at rest. And if its spin is up in the z direction, you can do a rotation on it and make it down or any other spin that you want. Okay? But a massless spin one particle is zipping along at the speed of light all the time, so you can never catch up with it. Okay? That means that the only kind of angular momentum that you can associate with it, spin angular momentum, is its spin in the direction of motion, helicity. Okay? And a photon, for example, which is a spin one particle, only has two polarizations. It's something you all know, right? There's no longitudinal polarization of the photon. It just has two transverse polarizations. A graviton has two polarizations. It's a helicity two. It has two polarizations, not five, which is the number of degrees of freedom you'd expect for a spin two particle. Massive spin two particle has 5 degrees of freedom. Massive spin 1 particle is 3 degrees of freedom. But a massless spin 1 and spin 2 particles, any massless particles, only have helicity. So they only have 2 polarizations at most. It turns out that that fact is incredibly, amazingly constraining. And that once you start getting to particles spin 0 and spin 1/2, the nature of the interactions are, there's a number of sort of interactions that you could have. But starting at spin 1 and higher, the rules are so constrained that there's a unique kind of theoretical structure that you can use to describe it. There's a basic rubric of things known as gauge theories, as I mentioned, not gauge symmetries, as we'll discuss later. They're more appropriately called gauge redundancies, and there are ways of allowing us to talk about the physics in a way that uses the standard language of local quantum field theory. It allows us to understand the locality of the interactions of these particles in a manifest way. But the rules are basically uniquely fixed on us. There's no choice for the world to be some other way, and it's this way because it's pretty and elegant. There's simply no other way for it to be. It's completely an inevitable consequence of quantum field theory. It's massless spin 1 particles are described by Yang-Mills theories, and that massless spin 2 particles are described by general relativity. The principle of equivalence, all of this stuff is just, there's no choice. They're just nailed, forced on you by quantum mechanics and special relativity. Okay? So GR is the unique way that at long distances, massless spin 2 particles can interact with each other. Yang-Mills theories are the unique way that photons and gluons and W and Z bosons can interact with each other. There's simply no other choice. This is the sort of thing that makes you think that you're on the right track when the structure we have is so rigid that you're not relying on flowery aesthetic judgment about what's beautiful or pretty like you might in a classical world. In this quantum world, things are just nailed and there's nothing you can do about them. That kind of inevitability is a very powerful hint that we're working with the right set of ideas. In particular, and another slogan which I'll come back to, but these things, gauge symmetries, diffeomorphisms, general covariance, these are all content-free notions. Okay, we'll discuss it, but they're completely content-free notions. There's nothing to any of them. They're a useful way of describing physics because we have a desire to describe things and interactions in a way that makes locality in space-time manifest. But that should not be an obvious statement right now. It'll be an obvious statement hopefully later in the week. But as a slogan, those are not fundamental things. And by now, we've seen many examples of systems where they come and go. Depending on how you choose to describe them, there either is or isn't diffeomorphism symmetry, or there is or isn't gauge symmetry. These are not fundamental things. But if you want to describe things using the standard language of local quantum field theory, they're a very convenient way of talking about things. So what I want to stress is that putting together quantum mechanics and relativity into quantum field theory gives an essentially unique framework for talking about particles and forces. The kind of interactions that we have at long distances are totally nailed. There's not much we can do about them. There's very good reasons we haven't seen spin 17 particles. There's very good reason. There isn't some infinite zoo of possibilities that could be. What we're seeing is the way it is because more or less it can't be any other way. And that's something that we understand very sharply and precisely already and which I will tell you about. Okay. So that's a big thing you're going to have to learn, as I said. Okay, let's assume that you've absorbed all of that and now we're going to move on to where the limitations are. Okay. So this picture of the world tells you that if you want to understand things at higher and higher energies, at shorter and shorter distances, you just collide particles into each other at higher and higher energies. Okay, and that's fine. If there wasn't gravity, so this is really it's really the legacy of the uncertainty principle. The reason we have to spend billions of dollars to accelerate particles at really high energies to probe short distances is because of the uncertainty principle, just directly because of the uncertainty principle. Okay, we want to probe very short distances, we need very, very high energies. If it wasn't for the uncertainty principle, we could build a little fantastic voyage spaceship and just make it smaller and smaller to see what's going on at short distances. But we can't do that. We can't do that because as you make the spaceship smaller and smaller, the uncertainty principle forces it to have lots of momentum, lots of energy. And so that's not tenable. Okay? Okay, so, but that's it. So we can, if in a world without any gravity, because of the uncertainty principle, we can't talk about positions and momenta. That's fine, but we can talk about just position. We can probe things at arbitrarily short distances. Okay? And we'll make more and more antiparticles and antiparticles coming out of the vacuum. We'll study whatever's going on. Nothing stops us, in principle, from measuring arbitrarily short distances. That breaks down in the presence of gravity. In order to see why, before jumping to this argument, let me point out an important feature of what I told you about earlier about gravity having a dimension-full interaction strength. Okay? See, normally we think about the force of gravity, let's say the ratio of the force of gravity between two electrons and the electric force. That, as we said before, is a tiny number, 10 to the minus 42 or whatever, right? And in a classical picture of the world, that ratio doesn't depend on the separation between them. Gravity is just always weak, right? The ratio, the r squareds cancel, right? The r squareds cancel, and so you just get the ratio as a number, 10 to the minus 42, right? That picture breaks down because of quantum mechanics and relativity, okay? Now, where should the breakdown start happening? The breakdown starts happening when the distance starts getting small compared to the Compton wavelength of the electron. Okay. So let's look at the ratio of F gravitational divided by F electric as a function of distance. And here I'm imagining this is going to shorter distances, I'm sorry. Okay. So here somewhere is H bar over M electron C, or let me just write as one over M electron. Okay. Out here, the ratio is this minuscule number, 10 to the minus 42 or whatever it is, okay? And it's a constant. It doesn't depend on distance. But when you get to one over M electron, this ratio starts going up. Now, actually, what I'm describing is very colloquial, because the whole notion of a force, potential, force, all of this stuff are very non-relativistic notions. They're not particularly useful notions relativistically. But still, for this sort of dimensional analysis purpose, it'll suffice. And you'll get the point. The difficulty is the following. You see, when I start pushing these two electrons together, okay, in order to measure the force, I'm trying to push them together so the distance between them is small, right? And I'm making them smaller and smaller. But what happens when that distance gets much shorter than one over M electron, is that I have to, again, by the uncertainty principle, supply a lot of energy just to keep them so close to each other, right? And that energy starts becoming big compared to the rest mass energy they have. In fact, how much energy, let's say the distance between them is delta R, or even let's say it's R, but let's say the R is much smaller than 1 over M electron. The amount of energy that I have to put in there is just comparable to 1 over R itself, right? Just by the uncertainty principle. So now the force would now be G Newton times M squared, but now the M's each have this 1 over R contribution. Okay? So the force would now be G Newton times 1 over R divided by R. Okay? So this would be what I mean by the potential. This only starts becoming applicable when R gets much smaller than 1 over M electron. Notice, right? When R is much bigger than 1 over M electron, the amount of energy I need to keep them confined is small compared to the rest mass energy. So this is irrelevant. But precisely when R gets much smaller than 1 over M electron, the dominant contribution to the energy in there is not the rest mass of the electron, but simply what you're doing to keep them so close to each other to begin with. Okay? So you see that now we get... So this is versus alpha over R, right? So you see that the relative strength of gravity starts growing. Okay? It starts growing. This is always alpha over R, but that starts growing. That's a nice way of talking about what we were saying before. The strength of the interaction is a dimensionless quantity, right? But it should be given by, if your distance is much smaller than the Compton wavelength of the electron, the mass of the electron is clearly irrelevant. If the energy is of order E, the basic strength of the gravitational interaction is G Newton times E squared. Okay? So it's getting stronger and stronger. It starts down here at 10 to the minus 42, but eventually it's growing as a square compared to E and M, and somewhere up here it hits around 1. Okay. If we ignore the alpha, which is a smallish, which is not, yeah. This becomes of order 1 over R, a big force, when R is of order L Planck, right? Again, that's the only units around is L Planck, and when R is of order L Planck, this strength becomes an interaction of order 1. It's, in fact, at that point, it's 137 times stronger than E and M. So it's actually catching up with E and M, the square root of 137 times before the Planck length, okay? Yeah? The horizontal axis is, yeah, let's say 1 over R. Okay. Yeah. That's why I said R is going shorter. So I should. Okay, so if that's 1 over R, that's an electron. You can give me a hard time if you want. And it's also not a, this is growing quadratically, right? So it's not a straight line.
Jeez.
All right. Okay, but so that shows quite vividly that, and also why quantum mechanics and relativity, that's the key thing. So gravity really does get stronger relative to the other forces as you head to a shorter distances. And at some really minuscule distance, it becomes comparable to everybody. Okay. Yeah?
As you get closer and closer, say, to an electron, and you start adding the pairs of electrons and positrons,
would you
be altering the charge as well then?
You are. In fact, that adding the pairs of electrons and positrons is this idea of vacuum polarization, which causes a slow change in the effective strength of alpha. So alpha does change logarithmically as you go to shorter and shorter distances. But for this argument, that's not a very important fact. It is there. Yeah.
Okay, one thing. At this scale of distance, does it make really all that sense to speak of distance? Because the electronic quads of the two electrons are completely overlapping by now.
This is why I was saying that really, this whole notion of a force and a distance and everything is very non-relativistic and isn't a very useful one here. More precisely, what's going on here is the following. More precisely, we imagine scattering two electrons with each other. Okay, and there's some amplitude for the electrons to scatter. Okay, so you just like potential scattering you study in quantum mechanics courses, you can scatter two electrons. Let's talk about the like something physical, like the cross section. The cross section for the scattering of two electrons. The cross section has units of this is a slightly more grown up way of talking about it. The cross section has units of area. Okay, so let's say I'm scattering two electrons at very high energy, E. And E is way bigger than the mass of the electron, so I can ignore the mass of the electron. So what's the cross section? The cross section just by dimensional analysis from if the center of mass energy, it should be a it's a Lorentz invariant notion. So the center of mass energy is the Lorentz invariant quantity we could be talking about. But the cross section goes like 1 over E center of mass energy squared, just by dimensional analysis. Okay, it has units of area. This is from E and M. If you're a little more careful, there's factors of alpha here, which makes sense, because if you didn't have any interaction, if alpha was zero, these things wouldn't scatter electromagnetically. So anyway, so that's what it looks like. But what is it from gravity? Gets contribution from gravity, which should be proportional to G Newton. Okay. But actually goes like E squared over M Planck to the fourth. Okay. So you see, it's exactly the same thing. At very low energies, this thing is tiny compared to that. But when the energies approach the Planck scale, they become comparable to each other. Okay, and this is the more correct way of talking about the force between the electrons. You can actually measure this, in principle, measure the scattering amplitude with some thought experiment, even. And then you would see that there's this contribution from gravity, which is utterly negligible at low energies, but which dominates and becomes comparable at high energies. Okay? Okay. Yes?
In the cross-section, gravitational cross-section, like it's like you are switching off the charge of the electron, and you are only seeing all the...
No, so really, there's two contributions. So the total cross-section would be the sum of these two pieces. Okay? But in your head, you can imagine switching one of them off and switching the other one off. So. Okay.
But if the forces have the same dependence, like why would the result...
This is the point. The forces, as a non-relativistic notion, have the same dependence. They look like 1 over r squared at long distances. But that e squared upstairs is reflecting the physics I just told you about. As you start bringing them very close to each other, you start putting a lot of energy into holding them close to each other. So in fact, it's really not an inverse square law anymore for gravity.
Okay, so we are considering the quantum.
That's right. This is all for energies, as I said, way bigger than me. Okay, so this is in the deep relativistic regime where we can ignore the mass of the electron. That's right. Okay, so that's the first statement about the Planck scale. When the energies approach the Planck scale, gravity really becomes comparable in strength to the other interactions. Okay, but something else happens. In order to tell you what the something else is, let's take a quick detour, and let me remind you about one of the remarkable features of gravity with very, very massive objects, which is that if you put a lot of mass into a really small region of space, you can make a black hole. Okay? So, if you have a lot of mass m in a region of size r, sorry about that. Okay. Then, when does it become a black hole? It becomes a black hole when gm over r is comparable to 1. This is when the escape velocity becomes comparable to the speed of light, which we're saying now in dimensionless units. Okay? So if you want the old Newtonian way of thinking about things, you would say it's when the potential energy gmm over r becomes comparable to the kinetic energy half mv squared. The m's cancel, so v squared is 2gm over r. That's the escape velocity, and we're setting the escape velocity equal to 1. To say that not even light can get out. Okay? So in fact, the formula of the 2 there is actually exactly correct. But let me just leave it as the squiggle here. Okay. So this says something. Actually, I want to stress something, because this picture, the actual black hole of general relativity, is much, much more dramatic than this picture. This is dimensional analysis, so it's getting you the correct answer. Okay? But this the black hole we just talked about, the way Newton would talk about it, or the way Laplace actually talked about it, is an object where if it's at that mass, then light, you could take light, you could shine light, you know, orthogonally away from the surface of this object, and light would just barely make it out to infinity, right? But if you didn't want to make it out to infinity, it would make it out plenty of long, long ways, okay? In no sense is this object actually truly black. If you stood close enough to it, things could easily get out, okay? However, in general relativity, it just does not get out. I mean, light, shining light at the horizon of a black hole, that distance from it, light just does not go out. It just bends sideways. But does not go out at all. So it literally becomes black. It's really very different. Even though the little dimensional analysis for when it happens is the same, the physics of the objects is incredibly different. Okay? It's a much more dramatic thing. It's one of the truly dramatic predictions of general relativity. We'll talk about black holes maybe 3 lectures. But this means something, that if you put too much, let's say you're trying to see what's going on inside that region of space, so nothing can get out. So if you put too much mass in too small a region of space, you'll never have access to what's going on in there. You can never see it. You can never probe what's going on. Okay? So that's a very basic fact. Okay, so now let's return to our thought experiment. Imagine a glorious world where politicians gave us all the money we wanted. We could build accelerators the size of the galaxy, do anything we wanted, and we want to just probe what's going on with physics. Our program is to understand short-distance physics as short distance as possible. Okay? The reductionist paradigm on acid. Okay? Just absolute, we're going to figure out the shortest possible distances. Very good. So we go at higher and higher energies. We collide things into each other at higher and higher energies. We use a better and better magnifying glass, whatever you want. But at some point, we put so much energy into such a small region of space. So in order to probe what's going on in this distance, delta r, right, we need an amount of energy, delta e, which is, again, of order 1 over delta r. So there's more and more energy in a smaller and smaller region of space. So at some point, we're going to collapse that region of space into a little black hole. So when does that happen? Well, when do you think it happens without doing any work? Obviously, the only words here are Planck. It's gravity. Like Planck, Planck, Planck everywhere. So this is going to happen at the Planck length. But let's see why. Let's see, just to gratify ourselves, let's see explicitly why. The amount of mass is 1 over, let's call it, 1 over delta r. So it's g newton, 1 over delta r is the energy. So it's gm over r is of order 1, right? That's what we want. So that's g over r, and then r is delta r, is of order 1. So it's when delta r squared is of order g newton, which is L Planck squared. So at around the Planck length is the first time something new happens. Because of quantum mechanics and relativity, the two words together, we see that our act of trying to probe short distances, all of a sudden something new happens. There's a problem. The little region we're trying to probe has collapsed into a black hole. We can't get any information about what's going on in there anymore. Yes?
What size the accelerator has to be for this experiment to work out?
Actually, this is an interesting separate question. There's many indications. This thing I said about a galactic-sized accelerator is actually not... that wouldn't get you to the Planck scale. There's amusing indications that if you try to build a physical accelerator with physical things in our world, that it's very hard to accelerate things to the Planck scale, period. But many of us suspect that that's not actually something fundamental, and so some clever accelerator design could actually do it. But if you took the LHC and you scaled it up to the size of the galaxy, what happens before you hit the Planck scale is that various, the beam buckles under its own weight. Various funny things happen. So it's there are some interesting papers on the apparent impossibility of accelerating things to the Planck scale. But it's probably not actually impossible. Yeah, anyway. Okay, so that's very interesting. We're trying to probe what happens at short distances. We're trying to give operational meaning to what's going on at short distances by doing a measurement. And we get foiled. Now, what if you say, damn, let me build an even bigger accelerator, right? What's going to happen? Let's say you build an even bigger accelerator now. It's still a black hole, but I mean, what is the sign of what happens? Do things get better or worse? They get worse because you make a bigger black hole. It has more mass, and you make a bigger black hole. So, you accelerate things up to the Planck energy, and you can't probe what's going on at Planck distances. You say, damn, now I'll build a 100 M Planck accelerator. That's fine. You just make something which is 100 times bigger than the Planck length. And you can't even see that anymore. Okay? What you used to be able to see at lower energies, you can't see anymore because you build this big black hole, which covers it up. So this is really fascinating. It's a very zeroth order thought experiment, one of these things that one has to come to grips with. This entire reductionist paradigm that we go to shorter and shorter and shorter distances, and that's where the most fundamental thing is, because of gravity, just breaks down. And there's, in fact, nothing, no operational meaning that you could possibly give to distances and times that are less than 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, 10 to the minus 43 seconds. Okay? So no experiment you can do can resolve distances and times that are smaller than that. Now, at this point, you could take two. So that's one of the zeroth order space-time is doomed arguments. There are more. There are more. There are more refined things that we'll come back to what we'll come back to later. That's the most zeroth order thing. Now, you could imagine that there really is such a thing as space-time, but we can't measure it because we make black holes. Okay. That's the sort of thing that's happened over and over again in physics. The story of physics for the past, for the past 100 years has been winnowing down the set of things we're allowed to talk about in a meaningful way. In a classical world, we could predict everything. Quantum mechanics came along and said, the word isn't positions and velocities, it's positions or velocities, okay? Okay, so you absorb that blow, the world isn't deterministic, that's fine. Okay, at least we get to measure distances, and then poof, quantum mechanics and gravity now tells you that, not even that space-time itself that was at least something that was left there as an arena for which everything else can operate acts. Even that isn't there anymore. You could take the attitude it's really there and we can't access it, just like you might take the attitude that there really is position and momentum, but we somehow can't talk about both of them. But this is a useless attitude, okay? It doesn't lead to any progress. It doesn't help you think about things in any new way. It doesn't help you come up with any new equations. And over and over again in the history of physics, we found instead that when there seem to be concepts and ideas that can't even in principle by any in principle experiment be measured, that means that they're not there. They're not there fundamentally in the description of the physics. Just like X and P are not there fundamentally in the description of quantum mechanics. Right? Ultimately, there's a state vector in a Hilbert space. Psi depends on X. There's the X representation, there's the P representation, but they're not to be talked about at the same time. And it does you no good to sort of hope that they're both there and just being obstructed somehow from talking about both of them. It's telling you a deep lesson, that it's just not there. The problem is that this is telling us a deep lesson, that the thing which is not there is space-time itself. Okay? And that's a really serious thing we have to come to grips with, because as I said, physics is normally about understanding what happens in space through time. Okay, so this is a very, very big challenge to how we think about things. Yes?
To get this result, we only used classical thinking, so there was
No. There was both, crucially both. We needed classical thinking for the black holes and quantum thinking for the fact that to probe higher energies, shorter distances, we need higher energies. It's a crucial ingredient of using both quantum mechanics and gravity. It's the first thing that happens when both things are happening at the same time. You see, normally, in all processes up to when you get to the Planck scale, and at very long distances when accidentally gravity dominates. Okay, so gravity dominates accidentally at long distances. Let's forget about that. It's mostly irrelevant until you hit the Planck energy. It's so weak, it's just irrelevant. You hit the Planck energy, and all of a sudden, it's telling you that the most cherished notion in physics is not really there. Okay? The space-time must come out of something else. As I said, this is way bigger deal than whether gravity is a fundamental force or not. Those are way incredibly secondary things to the fact that space and time itself has got to come out from something more critical. That's problem number one. Okay. When is lunch?
Half past.
Okay, very good. Okay. So now there's Actually, I think maybe what I'll do is, I don't think I can talk about the, maybe I'll start talking about the other problem. There's a deeper way of talking about this problem that we'll have to come back to. I'm trying to decide whether to start doing it now or go to the other problem. 10 minutes is a little difficult for both of them. Let me move on to the second set of problems. We'll come back to the deeper way of talking about this. The problem is that the deeper way of talking about this is going to take 40 minutes itself. Okay, so let's move on to the other problems. The other problems have to do with the existence of a macroscopic world, as I mentioned, and the mystery that a macroscopic world exists at all. Very colloquially and roughly, the point is that all of these virtual fluctuations that we talked about, these virtual particles, if you try to measure what's going on in some region of space-time, you see these particles and antiparticles. You see the sea of particles and antiparticles. There is energy associated with these vacuum fluctuations. It's just like the half h bar omega energy that you're used to with the ground state energy of the harmonic oscillator. Okay, and all of that energy adds up. In fact, it naively gives you a very large energy density of the vacuum. If you look at a little region, and you there's some energy in the vacuum fluctuations in that region. An even smaller region has an even bigger energy. So naively, it looks like you have a gigantic energy density in the vacuum. Okay, just coming from these half h bar omega. And naively, it's infinite, because you can make your little box arbitrarily small. The delta E is going like 1 over R. So the energy density is going like 1 over R to the fourth, where R is the size of the box. You make the R smaller and smaller, you have a gigantic infinite energy density. Well, we just learned here that space-time probably doesn't make sense for distances much smaller than the Planck length. But you might get an estimate for how big this energy density of the vacuum is just by cutting this off at around the Planck length. So you'd expect to get out of this an energy density of the vacuum of order, again, all the words are Planck, of order Planck energy density. So m Planck to the fourth is something you might estimate as a energy density of the vacuum. We can make this argument a little more precise in a second, but let me just keep going with it qualitatively. Now, what is the problem with that? Without gravity, there's no meaning to the energy, absolute energy of anything. As you know, you can subtract anything. Overall energies aren't well defined. You can add a constant. But that's not true in the presence of gravity, because everything gravitates. Okay? Even the constant energy density in just a vacuum also gravitates. And gravity leads to curvature of space and time, as even roughly. For the purpose of this rough argument, it doesn't even matter saying these things much more precisely. What do you think would happen if the vacuum had, because of these vacuum fluctuations that we just said are ubiquitous, are one of the direct consequences of putting together quantum mechanics and relativity, if we had an energy density of order the Planck scale, what kind of curvature would you expect for space-time? Gigantic curvature, right? It should be curved at the Planck length. So the typical length scale that things should be curved on should be 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. And in fact, that's what would happen. If the energy density was positive, if it was negative, you'd find that the universe was like crumpled to a space of negative curvature, with the negative curvature being 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. If the energy density is positive, you find the universe is explosively accelerating, doubling in size every 10 to the minus 43 seconds. Okay, but the words, the times, everything is Planck, Planck, Planck. All right? Looks absolutely nothing like our world. Absolutely nothing like our universe. Our universe has a nice, big, flat universe. We're just accelerating recently, but we're doubling in size every 10 billion years, which is very far from every 10 to the minus 43 seconds. Okay? Now, you can make this estimate that I just mentioned more quantitative. We can go through the derivation in a second, but it doesn't change the basic result. There are these gigantic vacuum fluctuations. They're a direct consequence of relativity and quantum mechanics, and they would lead you to a naive prediction, back over the envelope estimate, which is 120 orders of magnitude difference than the actual result that we observe. Okay? This is the single biggest disagreement between theory and a back of the envelope estimate in history. I used to say in physics, but we shouldn't insult the other sciences. I don't think anyone else has ever screwed up by so much. Okay, so it's to disagree between the back of the envelope and reality by 120 orders of magnitude is a serious problem. Okay, and it turns out that there's a little cousin of this problem, and as we set it up, you'll literally see it's a subleading correction in this problem, which would also make it impossible to believe that the weak scale is where it is and isn't also up at the Planck scale. You see, it's the basic problem. These vacuum fluctuations, by the uncertainty principle, there's vacuum fluctuations because of antiparticles. By the uncertainty principle, they're bigger and bigger at shorter and shorter distances. Why the heck is there a macroscopic universe? It sounds crazy, right? Everything is governed by gigantic fluctuations at minuscule distances. Why is there a big world? Why are things so nicely macroscopically correlated between here, there, there? Why is there a macroscopic universe at all? It's a very zeroth order qualitative question. Okay. Now, I told you we have this fantastic theory that agrees with everything. No experiment disagrees with it, and so on. So what the hell am I talking about, right? Well, I just said we do a back-of-the-envelope estimate. Something is off by 120 orders of magnitude. Forget all the detailed things about how electrons move around and scatter and so on. You know, the world is big. So how do we accommodate this fact? The answer is we literally do the following. This is literally what we do. We say, look, there is this quantum mechanical, sort of half h bar omega, vacuum fluctuation contribution to the energy density of the vacuum. So let's call that contribution the quantum correction to the vacuum energy. Okay? So the vacuum energy is often denoted by the symbol lambda. Okay? Let's say that lambda vacuum quantum. Imagine you compute it till you're blue in the face, and let me express the answer in Planck units. Okay? So let's say in Planck units you do it, and the answer is 1.27946, dot, 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 dot. I go for 120 decimal places. So here in the 121st decimal place is a 1, then a 3, then a 6, dot, dot, dot. Okay? That's what you get from these quantum fluctuations that we're just talking about. I'll make the estimate more precise in a second, but imagine that that's what you get. We say there just happened to be lying around a classical contribution to the vacuum energy. Okay? Guess what? That classical contribution was negative 1.27946 dot 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 136 dot 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 dot. Okay? That's what we do. Actually, this is what we used to do until 1997, thereabouts. Back in 1997, you see, this looks completely absurd, right? Because these things have nothing to do with each other. Naively, absolutely nothing to do with each other. This is a quantum correction. This is something classically sitting there already. They should have nothing to do with each other. And for justifiable reasons, an obvious reason, this is called fine-tuning, right? It's like you're just twiddling the dials of the parameters of the theory, and making an adjustment happen in this way, right? So they cancel. Now, in 1997, people still believe this. Everyone knew that this problem has been around for a long time. But somehow, you might think there is some very deep principle you haven't discovered yet that would tell you that this is exactly opposite to that for some reason. Maybe it's a new symmetry. Maybe there is something out there that correlates them perfectly with each other. Okay. So that was the fantasy, that some such principle would be found, even though no one had ever had a concrete proposal for what it might be. But you see, that would really say that it's this to 120 decimal places, and it continues to agree past 120 decimal places as well. But then people discovered that the universe is accelerating. Now, the simplest possible explanation, we'll review it, but the simplest possible explanation for why the universe is accelerating, and by far the best one, vastly better than any of the other ones, even given this problem, this is better than all the other ones. It tells you how crappy the other ones are. Okay, but the best explanation is that there is a tiny non-zero value of the cosmological constant, which is not 1, but 10 to the minus 120 or so in Planck units. Okay, but what that means is that now, post-1997, we have to imagine that that lambda classical is this, and it starts differing in the 121st decimal place. Okay, so it's 4. It's a little bit positive. Okay. Oh, I guess it's 2. Okay, 7. It can do whatever it wants after that. Okay. So they have to agree to 120 decimal places, but disagree in the 121st decimal place. Okay. Yes.
So that classical contribution was actually there. Someone just said that it has to be there.
No, it just has to be there.
It's a completely made up.
It's a completely made up thing. But it's a parameter in the theory. It is a parameter in the theory. So this is why it is not incorrect to say we have this successful theory. It's perfectly correct. We've just chosen the parameters of this theory amazingly, amazingly accurately. Okay? We've finally adjusted them to 120 decimal places to avoid this problem. And furthermore, even the adjustment we're making, we can't even now hope or fantasize anymore that this adjustment is going to come from some deeper principle that will just make them equal and opposite. They actually have to differ a little bit. Okay. So that's just been amazingly shocking. And this is it. This is our explanation. Okay, guys? You know, that's it. So obviously, this is a problem. This is indicating something very, very, something is very wrong. Somewhere, something is very wrong. We need to come up with an explanation, a better explanation for why this is the way it is. There's many analogies, but one analogy I'd like to use is that it's like walking through into a room and seeing a pencil standing on its tip on a table. Okay, with a 10^-120 degrees of vertical. It's possible. It's not inconsistent. It's some initial conditions that's allowed. It's perfectly possible. But if you saw it, you would wonder if something is up. Right? Or maybe you'd look for a string hanging from the ceiling. Okay? Or maybe you'd look to see if there's a little hand holding it up. Or you'd look for something. Okay? Even though it's in principle possible for it to be like that, you would think you're missing a mechanism. There's something up. Yeah. So, and as I say, this problem is associated not with some egghead concern about the seventh decimal place in some calculation, but with answering a very basic question: why is there a big world at all? Why is there a macroscopic universe?
So, okay, for a minute, we should stop
here. Right.
So, okay, did let me make a couple of announcements. So,
okay. Okay, sure.
Just a couple of announcements. We will start again exactly at 2 o'clock. At 2 o'clock, and don't forget that tomorrow the lecture also starts at 9 o'clock. Not at 9:30, but at 9 o'clock. So every day during this week, the lecture will start exactly at 9 o'clock. The lunch is ready. The lunch is ready. There are plenty of sandwiches and 6 vegetarian dishes. So if you're not vegetarian, please don't take the dishes for vegetarian food. So that's pretty much all. Okay, we'll start again here at 2 o'clock.